All right, so we're continuing with our YAO 2012 conversations with speakers. We're with Don Reinertsen, and you do some very interesting work in what I guess we call lean, the sort of the buzzword. So I wanted to talk to you about what that means and also kind of dig into some of what you talked about in your keynote. So please tell us a little bit about yourself to begin.
I'm a sort of a engineer and MBA. It's probably just worth knowing the origin of me because it affects the frames with which I look at the problems and things. I'm original electrical engineer by training, and then in the Navy I was trained as a nuclear engineer on nuclear submarines. I got my MBA and then went to work for the consulting company McKinsey and Company, which does a lot of strategy work and things, but tends to be very big on fact-based analysis and, you know, rather than just repeating platitudes, really approach problems more analytically.
Okay.
And so for a lot of the stuff I do in product development, I tend to be looking at the problems as quantitative and engineering problems as opposed to viewing them as, is this philosophy better than that philosophy?
Okay.
And so now I've been doing this in the product development space for a very long time. I think I've become a little more visible in the software world and the methodologies that I use in terms of viewing things as quantitative trade-offs between competing forces is refreshing for some people in software where, you know, some of these issues tend to be ideological battles.
Uh-huh.
Now, I originally was focusing on just shortening product development cycles, and the reason I focused on that is we would treat a project like a black box. We would say which of the outcomes of this project are most important economically. We'd do a sensitivity analysis. We'd see that cycle time was worth a lot of money. If it would cost me a lot if I was late in life cycle profit. And then we would start looking at techniques to shorten development cycles. And so early in my career in the 80s and 90s and stuff, I was focused primarily on just what management practices allow people to do faster product development. From when you get the original idea until when you produce revenue out the other end, what specific things in team organization, in architecture, in control systems do you do that will produce more rapid product development?
Mm-hmm.
In the 80s, after I left McKinsey, I was doing manufacturing turnaround work. And I was in a company where we would buy broken factories and fix them. I got very interested in the Japanese manufacturing techniques, and I saw some of the patterns in manufacturing that were exploitable in the world of product development. Things like managing inventory, things like reducing batch size in processes. So back in around 91, I started writing about why don't we use some of these manufacturing ideas in our development processes. Nice. In the mid-90s, this was before the term lean product development really existed. And so this was before even lean, because the MIT folks came and took the Japanese manufacturing techniques, rebranded them as lean, and really brought them to the mainstream. So for most of the mainstream world, they think of lean manufacturing as originating in the lean manufacturing movement. But in the manufacturing world, it really started happening about 10 years earlier than that, when they were translating a lot of the Japanese books. But, you know, it was absolutely critical for the industry that somebody rebranded it and brought it to the mainstream, because it would have been much less valuable to us in American industry without that.
Okay.
But so as the concept of lean management emerged, and as the label lean product development emerged, I started relabeling some of my stuff lean product development. And it's there are different flavors of lean product development out there right now. It's still a relatively new field. So you'll see some people who say, well, lean product development is just what Toyota does because Toyota is lean. I tend to be of a different school of thought, which is that lean product development is a more broad umbrella, that there are certain techniques that make lean manufacturing work, certain logical and mathematical principles, and it's those principles that we want to apply in product development. It's not the behaviors of lean manufacturing that we want. It's really the thinking process.
So let's dig into that, because so help me visualize what that means.
Okay. So one of the standard practices in lean manufacturing, one of the tools of lean manufacturing, is this technique called 5S, where what they try to do is they try to organize the workplace. And so they will create these boards with outlines of wrenches on them so that the wrench always goes back in the same place and you can always find the wrench. So lean manufacturing consultants will go into engineering departments and they will say, the CEO will tell the engineering department, you need to get lean. The engineering department says, I don't know what that means. And the CEO will say, well, fortunately, my manufacturing people do, so I'll get them to lend you one of their consultants. And the consultant comes into the engineering department and says, you know, I see what your problem is that, you know, your engineers have staplers in all different locations on their desk. And this is, you know, Mark Twain used to say, truth is stranger than fiction because fiction has to make sense. So this is true. This is not a thought experiment. This has really happened.
All right.
So the lean consultants would start drawing white outlines for the staplers on the desk and things. And in this one particular case, there was an engineer who had a banana on their desk. And the question was, can we really permit a banana to be on the desk of the engineer without an outline? And they said, yes, we will draw an outline for the banana on the desk, but the banana cannot be on the desk unless the engineer is really using it. So they then said, you know, we're going to define an active banana versus an inactive banana. An active banana is going to be one you're going to consume in the next 15 minutes, and an inactive one is one you'll consume after that.
Okay.
Now, why does this problem occur? It's because in manufacturing, we work on physical objects, and what you can see is what is really going on. So there's a standard practice in lean manufacturing where they call go to Gemba, go to the scene of the crime, go to the shop floor, open your eyes, and you see everything that's going on. If you use the same technique in engineering, you go to the engineering lab and you just look and observe. The artifacts of engineering are information, which is intrinsically invisible. What you will see is you will see the physical artifacts. You will see the stapler, you will see the banana, you'll see the copy machine that is underutilized. If you come from a manufacturing background, since all relevant information is present in those physical objects, you will attack those things. If you actually understand engineering, what is the issue of where are the queues, what is the batch size, what is happening to the flow in the process, that is all information, and you have to find a way to illuminate that portion of the process to really find where the body is buried. So I was talking with some guys at HP many years ago, and we were talking about what's inventory in an engineering process. And they said, our inventory is bits on a disk drive, and we have very big disk drives here at HP. And so what happens is you could double the amount of inventory in an engineering process, which is going to affect the cycle time, but you could walk into that engineering process before and after the inventory doubled, and you would see no observable sign that that change has occurred. If you walked into a factory, you would see piles of stuff on that factory floor. So what then happens when you start trying to use these ideas in product development environments, one of the things you have to do is to start making this invisible stuff visible. And that's what we do often with the card walls and Kanban boards and things like that, is that as we can start creating physical artifacts that map to this invisible stuff, we can start seeing the queues and the batch size and what's going on in our process, and start seeing it in the same way a manufacturing person ends up seeing it.
Interesting. Now, I've had some interesting conversations with people here over the course of the event, and there's sort of a disagreement with the notion of software as a manufacturing process, so building applications and building services as sort of a manufacturing process versus it being some sort of semi-manufacturing process, and you know, is software engineering really engineering, this kind of thing. So my question for you would be, what do you make of things like programmer anarchy that one of your speaker colleagues
Fred.
Because that seems to be like, let's randomly throw things out there and see what sticks, which isn't really something you would do in manufacturing.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really sort of my question.
Yeah, I think where you start seeing, I mean, we can use a lot of manufacturing ideas, but we need to use them with respect for the difference in the structure of engineering and manufacturing. So, for example, you know, in general, in manufacturing, you can do the same thing a million times in a row, you make money every time. In engineering, you do the same thing twice in a row, and the second time you've wasted money. We produce the recipes for products. We don't produce the products, the physical artifacts. You got to change the recipe. What that means is the run length of your work is very short. You're often doing one-off stuff. And many of the ideas of manufacturing work much better when you're doing these long run length repetitive processes. So for example, one of the things you do in factory is, in a mass production factory, is the Japanese do is you stop the line when you find a defect. And you say, you know, the red car came out reddish blue and things. I need to stop the line so I don't produce a lot of waste. Mm-hmm. Well, that works when you're doing repetitive, because the probability that the next one is going to look like the one you just did is extremely high. But when you're doing this very small batch size that you have in product development, the fact that you found a defect in one item doesn't really predict that the next one you're going to see is going to have the same defect. Mm. And you can think of it almost like if you were in a hospital emergency room and you started having a stop-the-line philosophy, you would say, oh, one doctor made a mistake, the medicine was in the wrong bottle and things like that, so I'm going to pull the Andon cord and the red alarm will go off and I'll have every doctor stop working on every patient until we end up fixing this defect. Silly in an environment where you have non-homogeneous flow, where you have cost of delays present and things. Wonderful idea in manufacturing. Hmm. And so I think when you start seeing some of the practices Fred was discarding there, they were things like estimating. Is he de-emphasized estimating. And there's some real question if you're estimating two things that are fundamentally different from one another, what the real value of doing that estimate is. Mm-hmm. Is that, I mean, you may have, it's sort of like I'm flipping a coin and I'm counting the number of heads versus the number of tails and things like that. There are some aggregate statistics that I would expect to see half as many heads as half as many tails, and I'd like to know mean outcomes in processes and variance and things like that. I'm not really going to want to get into the business of trying to say whether an individual coin flip is going to be heads or tails. That's a losing proposition at that level. And so, you know, I guess what I see people doing is maybe getting... and now he's in a particular environment, but I think people may be getting a little more realistic about, does the practice really end up giving me economic benefits? And maybe doing some little trials of saying, why don't I do an experiment? Why don't I stop doing this and see if my economics go to pot when I stop doing that?
Mm.
And so I really think, I don't think as much as I would classify it as it's all art and every problem is 100% different than the other one, and that there is no usable carryover from problem to problem. I would characterize it more as there is a portion of it that is new and high variability, and we can use techniques that allow us to exploit the portion that is not high variability and still deal with the variability. The analogy I would use is, for example, if you see a good doctor's office scheduling and things, they will not schedule 100% of their time for appointments. They will have a certain amount of walk-in and crisis work that they have to handle. The fact that there is some walk-in and crisis work doesn't mean that you don't prepare any schedule at all. What you do is you prepare a schedule of appointments, you pre-position time slots throughout the day that are uncommitted, and then if the walk-in patients come in at 9 a.m. in the morning, you delay one of the patients who is waiting for an appointment to handle the crisis, and then you catch up when you've got that time slice becoming available. And so there are some nice techniques we can use to combine predictable work with unpredictable work in a very effective way, rather than, you know, I think the software industry tends to suffer a lot from this sort of exclusive or type thinking, is that either it is 100% unpredictable or it is 100% predictable, and I have only two operating points that I can end up using. And there's a lot of, I think, richness in these mixed strategies of saying I'm gonna do some stuff that will help the portion of the work that is more predictable while still respecting the fact I've got an important component that is highly variable that I'm gonna have to manage.
Absolutely, and I mean, that's sort of, you know, this is a very unreliable industry in the sense that we don't know, it's hard to predict what's going to be successful. And so in that kind of environment, like, how do you apply what you've just talked about to galactic-sized software projects where, let's say, an operating system like Windows, where you have tremendous amounts of code and lots of components in a very, very complex system, which is true for any general purpose operating system.
Yeah.
How do you rationalize this type of philosophy or this quantitative analysis or, you know, mathematics that you're trying to describe to a system that's so big that has to preserve years and years of legacy?
Yeah.
Right. You can't just pretend like nothing else exists because something new is coming, which you really don't have to do in cars. So when you buy a new car, it's a new car. Yeah. You don't have the baggage from the other car.
Right.
So I guess the question I'm trying to ask is, how do you apply your thinking to gigantic software?
Yeah. So I'm reminded of an old joke that they would tell in New England, where this New Yorker comes up to a Maine farmer and he asks him, "How do I get to Boston from here?" And the Maine farmer looks at him and says, "You know, if I were trying to get to Boston, I wouldn't start from here." And you know, I think the problem of large operating systems with tight coupling between system elements that cause a lot of interactions between system elements and things, and extremely wide variation within the user base and things of the environment in which it ends up going into, and the legacy problem and things like that, that turns it into sort of a worst in class problem. Now, I think you can do some things, like I was struck many years ago about the effect of the shared DLLs in Windows, where what would happen would be the people were doing a shared DLL to get some code reuse and to get some economies of scale and testing and things like that. But it turned out, because the DLL was being used by a number of different programs, it had to exist in lots of rev levels because the programs were changing at different times. And once you had 50 DLLs existing in 20 different rev levels and things, then you say, well, what's every possible combination of permutation that I might see in this system? And it's, you know, 20 to the 50th test cases that you would have to do to really get 100% coverage, which would take the life of the universe to do. And you wouldn't even want to do that because most of those test cases would never even show up in the life of the universe, I think. Now, there are some interesting architectural things you can do because, in fact, when you choose to make that DLL a rather large chunk of code, then it's going to have to exist in even more rev levels. If you partition that down to actually a smaller chunk, it gets hit with less change requests on the things. It ends up sort of existing in less different rev levels in the process. And you massively reduce the testing burden that you're going to end up having if you make some good architectural choices on the shared components. So there is, and I think in general what has happened is that's the direction that some of the Microsoft operating systems have gone.
Sure.
But I think there are some smart choices related to, you know, coupling on things and architecture that can alleviate some of the problems. I think they don't fundamentally turn it into an easy problem, though.
Sure.
Is that, you know, so I guess my feeling is we're probably going to make traction on the new techniques on the simple and medium difficulty problems and refine the ideas. And they're going to have to achieve some degree of refinement before you can start scaling them up to the really big problems.
Absolutely.
And so, you know, I'm not sure the entry point for trying to prove the ideas work are on the largest systems. I think ultimately you're going to see a lot of value from it, but I'm not sure that's the place I would start. Now, let me give you just one other example that I tend to use a lot of queuing theory in my work. Because, you know, queuing theory started in the telecommunications industry, and it was sort of an issue of how many lines do I need for a town of 10,000 people? Do I need one phone line or 10,000 phone lines? Mm. And before, there was a guy, Erlang, in Denmark who first did the work there. But before he came along, people said, look, phone calls come in at random times, they have random durations, there's no way to analyze this. But at the turn of the 20th century, statistics was emerging as a field. Erlang was a mathematician. He started applying statistics to it. Now, interestingly, what you look at in telecommunication system design, things like the internet and stuff, we use queuing theory to deal with this extraordinarily high level of variability in a process. We don't make the assumption we can get people to send messages when we want them to. We don't make the assumption they're going to limit their size of the thing. So we design the entire internet to function cost effectively and reliably in the presence of very high levels of variability. And we do that by a lot of congestion control protocols that we do to prevent overloading and congestion collapse on links. But we thought through the problem as assuming that we have the fundamental constraint of variability present. So our engineering solution has to work in the presence of variability. Hmm. And I think in many ways, the same thing actually applies even when you're doing these very large scale processes like operating systems, where you say, you know, a common mistake that people make in engineering all the time is to load their resources to 100% utilization. And so what happens is the resource is always blocked at the time you're trying to access the resource. You end up having very high queues. And anyone who understood queuing theory would say, look, you can't load to 100% utilization because your wait times are going to become infinite if you keep trying to drive to high levels of utilization. Mm-hmm. Now, if you had more consciousness and awareness of the fact that loading resources to very high levels of utilization was producing delays in people's ability to respond and to fix problems in your process. And you structured your process with higher levels of capacity margin in order to end up getting better response times. What you would end up seeing is it is even easier to do very big, large, complex systems if you approach it as saying it intrinsically has high variability. I need to design the system as if I am dealing with a stochastic problem, not a deterministic problem. I can't have everybody, the classic example I give is field service, right? How high a level of utilization could you load a field service organization to and still provide good responses to customers? Rule of thumb is probably 70% utilization. If you start loading above 70% in field service, when the customer call needs come in at random times, and you're going to be telling the customer, I'm sorry, all of my people are out right now. They weren't out yesterday, but they're all out today. Mm-hmm. So you get very bad response time if you try to load to 90% utilization on field service. And yet you would look at things like engineering, and it is, I used to teach classes at Caltech for executive courses that I had people from all different companies. The average product developer was loading their engineering organization to 98.5% utilization. Mm. Fundamentally, you cannot get products out the door quickly if you load to 98.5% utilization, because you're going to have your resources always going to be blocked at the time you try to access it.
Interesting.
So I actually think, while the big projects are difficult entry points and things, I think we're still likely to find that there are some fundamentally huge mistakes being made on how people try to pack, everything up to full utilization and things, which tends to leave these people blocked most of the time, which means that if I start going down a wrong path, and my feedback loops take a long time to inform me I'm going down a wrong path, I consume lots of resources heading in the wrong direction before I shut it down. Hmm. And so I've got this organization where everybody's working 80-hour weeks and things like that. Hmm. Everybody is absolutely packed to the gills, but it's still taking a long time for stuff to get through the system. And it's because you don't have any margin. You have not loaded key high variability stages with enough capacity margin to get fast loop closure times in the process. So there are some very fundamental things that are. And just as a reference point, So if you were trying to manage that way, you would measure queues and you would say, what does the queue cost me? What does it cost me to have more capacity? And if the cost of the capacity is cheaper than the cost of the queue, I'd want to have more capacity in that process. It's like, hospital emergency room, you don't want, 50 heart attacks waiting in line because you don't want to bring another doctor into the room. Now, so the interesting question is, okay, so that's a very logical thing to do. How many people are equipped to do that? Mm-hmm. So I speak at metrics conferences and I ask people, how many of you are measuring the size of queues in your development process as a key metric? 2% of the hands go up. 100% of people measure cycle time, 2% of the people measure queues. I ask people, how many of you know the cost of delay of what you're working on, the project? If the CEO came to you and said, if we delay this project by 30 days, how much does it cost our shareholders? Would you give the same answer as the guy sitting next to you? Hmm. The answer is, in the typical organization, in the engineering world at large, only about 15% of product developers know what the cost of delay is on the projects that they're working on. And so you would have to know both the size of the queue and the cost of delay to know what the queue is costing you. Mm-hmm. So what we've got is a world where about 1% of product developers really know the economic costs of the queues that they are creating by loading to close to 100% utilization. Hmm. And now you'll see people who are solving the problem without realizing they're solving a queuing problem. Like you see the Google 20% time where people say, okay, we're going to build this 20% excess capacity. They say they don't label it as excess capacity, they label it as the creative fun stuff. But when you talk to people who are actually at Google and you say, well, when the stuff you're working on 80% of the time falls behind schedule, what do you do with the 20%? Do you work on the stuff that's behind or do you work on your next new idea? Yeah. Their answer is, duh, you know, of course I work on the stuff that's behind. Mm-hmm. So 3M has done that for 40 to 50 years in their innovation processes, having 15% excess capacity. So people have empirically discovered that that is an important thing to do. But you can actually bring more science and intelligence to it than most people, you know, because obviously the point is 15% the right number? You're trading off a holding cost versus a cost of capacity. Those things will be bigger and smaller in different circumstances. Some places you'd want 30% excess capacity, other times places you'd want 10. If you can bring it into a more quantitative frame, you can start making sort of more intelligent decisions about exactly where in your process do you really want to have some capacity margin.
So in the engineering world, as you know, in the software engineering world, how would you sort of enforce this type of thing? So let's say, you know, we decided, okay, from now on, we're never going to push to 100% capacity of developers, you know, time. Mm-hmm. Such that we can respond to change quickly or get feedback loops and sort of what you were talking about.
Yeah.
However, not all developers work that way, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you have a different class of problems. You have some people that might be working on UI problems, and you have some people that might be working on sort of the low-level kernel-type problems.
Right.
And interfacing closely with hardware that also changes quickly, and so there's sort of a lot to learn and a lot to do. How do you enforce amongst that spectrum of engineering that, hey, you know, we're not going to max yourselves out all the time? Because the way that you're speaking is sort of the higher level, the way you really should run a business. I mean, it sounds great. And theoretically, it sounds perfect. But in reality, how would you enforce that?
And so when you... when you get down to the really detailed level in individual person and things, sometimes if you say, okay, I want you to spend 25% of your time doing nothing, that makes people feel uncomfortable about whether they're really worthwhile to the organization if they're doing nothing. So what I usually suggest people end up doing is I say, look, you know, you actually don't want to load them to have just pure capacity margin idle time in the process. What you want to do is you want to load a portion of their activities with low priority work that it is very easy to disengage from. So, you know, I want you to be supporting the coding of this kernel and things like that, but I also want you to work on a advanced R&D vision of where this thing is going to be 3 years from now and things. And I want you to spend one day a week working on that advanced R&D vision and things. It's not a really perishable task. It doesn't have the high level of urgency. So when you steal clock cycles away from that one and things, you don't feel like you're really jeopardizing the entire organization. Mm. But you're not busy twiddling your thumbs, you know, at the same time. The other thing that actually turns out to be quite important is it's easy to explain it with a diagram, but the queuing curve that you would see looks something like this, where it rises very steeply when you get to 100% utilization. And if you try to manage on that queuing curve by trying to assign a level of capacity utilization, you sort of say, I'm going to run my organization at 82% capacity utilization. The problem is, can you estimate the productivity of an engineer on a task they've never done before, plus or minus 10%? You really can't. Can you estimate the work content in a job you've never done before, plus or minus 10%? You can't. So you might be sitting at 55%, you might be sitting at 95%. I've never seen anybody that's good enough to really measure their capacity utilization well enough to make it a useful control variable. But the point I make with them is, if you look at how steep that curve is, the vertical axis is Q size. So instead of choosing capacity utilization as your control variable, choose the Q size, how much stuff you have in flight at a particular time. Mm-hmm. So it's actually much more effective operationally to implement capacity margin by saying, what we're going to do is we're going to control the occupancy in the system. We're going to have no more than a certain number of things in flight at a particular time. And every time we finish one, we will then open up a slot to put another one in the air. Mm. So from a practical perspective, what you'll actually find is the best way to implement a organization that has sufficient capacity to deal with contingencies is actually a more indirect approach of saying, we're going to control the number of active projects that we have in flight. Mm. And invariably, when you cram too much stuff into the pipeline, that's what will generate the queues and create the very long response times in the process.
Excellent.
So there are some back doors that we can go into in a very practical way, get people to operate in a posture that they can respond to variation more effectively by simply controlling the number of things they're working on. Mm. Now, there is one other class of problem that we have to worry about in engineering, that in manufacturing is that work is intrinsically bounded. If I tell somebody, machine the shaft to 1 inch in diameter, when they reach 1 inch, they stop. A lot of the work that we have in engineering behaves like the perfect gas of physics. It expands to fill the container no matter how big you make the container. So you end up telling people, I want you to work on conceptual design for 2 weeks. They can use 2 weeks. You say, how about 4 weeks? They can use the full 4 weeks. How about 8 weeks? They can use the full 8 weeks. And so one of the things we need to do, be a little careful about, is the class of work that we have that intrinsically ends up expanding a thing. And on those, now, and interestingly, I'll often point out to people, non-software people, I'll say, look, you know, who knows how to solve that problem? I said, software people know how to solve that problem. Mm-hmm. You're just a mechanical engineer. That's why you don't know how to solve that problem. But software people have been solving that problem for the last 50 years. When you dispatch a job to an operating system, you don't end up saying work on that job until it's done, because the job might have an infinite loop in it. If you say work until you're done, it might take the life of the universe. So what we do is we use watchdog timers, we use timeouts, we use techniques like round robin scheduling to prevent things from expanding to infinite time. Mm. I actually believe that some of those methods we use to prevent stuff from blowing up on us are actually directly transportable into the way that we end up managing flows in engineering processes.
Interesting.
And things. I think that there's still a lot of money left on the table. Is that, you know, the operating system design, you know, that has been around for 40 to 50 years, mm-hmm. has come up with very intelligent ways with dealing with non-homogeneous flows and unpredictable flows and processes, and has thought so carefully about that it could essentially automate many of the techniques and things.
Interesting.
And then, you know, I think the interesting question when you're talking to software people is, you say, hey, I mean, you guys know more about this problem than anybody else in the world. Why aren't you using those ideas to deal with the non-homogeneous flows and the variability that you see inside your development process? I mean, isn't that just like operating system design?
Interesting.
And people say, duh.
Yeah. Yeah, because you think about like when you build a a workflow in a program environment or an execution environment, and then but you don't actually implement a workflow based that could be based on that in your working environment where you're producing the software. It's very interesting. I also like the idea of developer timeouts, right? Like,
because exactly. You got a program running. You go ahead and pull it out of the core. Look at what instruction statement you're at and things like that. You check again. A second later, it's still at the same instruction statement. Things like that. Sometimes pull it out of the oven. You see if you're still making progress. Mm-hmm. And if the thing has completely stalled, it's time to rethink what you're doing. And because interestingly, on a lot of technical stuff, you'll tend to find these asymptotic relationships as progress starts flattening out. You reach a point of diminishing returns. Mm-hmm. And once you continue to expend effort on it and the actual progress function is flattening out and things like that, you need to ask the question, is the effort that I'm trading really being returned in terms of an improvement in the performance of this product? Hmm. And even when you have no clue what the S-curve is that you're on, you have no clue whether this thing is going to flatten out after 1 week of work or after 8 weeks of work, you can still monitor what that progress function is and saying, when I see it flattening out, that's a sign that I've reached diminishing returns on it. Hmm. So I really do think there is potential to use some of the great thinking that we've done over the years on problems. And it's like, I love round robin scheduling because, in round robin scheduling, you end up saying, how do I ensure long jobs take more time than short jobs, even if I have no prior knowledge which one is the long job? I give it a quanta of time. If it clears in one quanta of time, it's done. Otherwise, it goes back in the queue and waits for another quanta and another quanta. The heuristic we use is 80% of jobs sort of clear in one quanta of time. And so what does that do? That means I may have no idea which job is going to take the most time and things like that, but by assigning quanta of time, short ones will actually get done faster than long ones with no prior knowledge as to which one was the long one. And, so why don't we start using that for some of these tasks that we do where we have really no information of what we're going to get, how much technical progress we're going to actually make and things like that. Mm. Why not use some of those ideas that we end up using in operating systems of, okay, I'll give you a chunk of time and effort to put into this thing. Let's see what you get done. If you provide an adequate solution in one chunk of time, then I'm not going to give you another chunk of time. If you don't, I'll give you another one. If I see that progress is completely flattened out, then I may not give you the third or fourth quanta of time. Mm. And I would sort of make the analogy is, oh, by the way, that's exactly how venture capitalists end up funding companies and things like that. Hmm. They don't assume they can know exactly how much money it's going to take to get to an endpoint and things like that. They release a small chunk of funds. They see what people get done with that chunk of funds. And based on the progress they make in that first chunk of funds, they end up setting the terms on the financing for the next round and things. And so when marching forward in the unknown, in a very foggy environment and things, that this notion of, okay, I'll release a chunk of resources to buy myself information and use that information to make my next decision is a pretty well-established strategy.
Absolutely.
You just need, I think what you need to get people to do is to abstract the mechanisms of action so they can end up applying it in another spot.
Cool. Yeah. So I think the final question I'll ask you today is, if you look at, since you've been involved in this industry for so long, and in manufacturing in general, and obviously your educational background and your ability to communicate effectively, what do you see as, like, if you look at where we are with computing today, and this tendency that we have towards, super rapid delivery, super rapid innovation, experimentation, cloud computing, massively distributed systems and lots and lots of people actually computing. So the number of people that compute also increases to, and as do the number of problems that we have to solve in the field of computing. So, you know, talk to us about sort of what you see.
Where's the future going to be?
What's the future?
I'm not a
understood.
Not a futurist and things like that.
Of course
but,
not.
But I guess, you know, I can connect some dots anyway without me. And I guess what I tend to see is that as people are moving to smaller batch size, as they're moving to incremental deliveries and things like that, I think the software business starts looking more like the newspaper business than it looks like the car manufacturing business, in the sense that you buy a car, which is a large batch of functionality that you get at one point in time, but you subscribe to a newspaper. Is that, you know, you're choosing to have an ongoing relationship with a newspaper that you're, now these newspapers are disappearing and things like that. But the model when it was working was that I have enough faith that tomorrow's paper is going to be something of value because I've had a chance, I've had 365 opportunities in the last year to assess whether that newspaper produces something I want to read. And so people will essentially subscribe to it as a service without knowing what the product they're going to be getting 24 hours later is, because they have faith that you've been continuously improving the thing all along. And so I think that affects pricing models. It affects your selling process. You know, a newspaper is not selling you to subscribe by saying this is tomorrow's news and things like that. They're not selling the product that they're going to deliver tomorrow to you. They're selling sort of a relationship, an ongoing stream of, you know, these are the type of things we end up doing. So I think my suspicion is what you're going to see is you're going to be moving to more continuous flow, very small changes and things, changes that are so small sometimes they're not even marketable. You wouldn't want to try to market the difference between the Tuesday newspaper and the Wednesday newspaper and things. But I think it's going to switch to more of a subscription-based model of the thing. And the companies that are continuing to keep their products fresh by continuing to stream these ongoing improvements and it are the ones that are going to be, the people are going to say, yeah, I love reading the New York Times. There's always something new and interesting in the New York Times. My local paper and things like that just doesn't have as many articles that really get me excited.
Absolutely. And it'll be interesting to see what impact this consistent need to update and refresh is going to do to the practices that you've spent the last, you know, 30 minutes talking about. That too will have to evolve in some sense, right? I mean,
I think, you know, the more people are adding value by saying, I'm selling you a relationship with me for my continuous stream of, you know, of updates and improvements and things like that, that's going to put even more pressure on the developers to produce a continuous stream of updates. Is that, you know, if that's what you're selling, you better deliver on the promise.
Yes.
So
let's see what happens. And thank you for your time. This is very interesting and incredibly useful. So thanks for coming and joining
us. My pleasure.
On Channel 9.